read, a charge, non-taxed thing in the United States that we've had for 50 years, 55 years. And along came digital television that took it away from three-quarters of the population east of New York City. The reason I'm specifying east of New York City is that there's a complicated antenna pattern coming out of Empire that doesn't favor east of New York City. The guys in Jersey, west of New York City, they're a little bit better off. But still, guaranteed, they're not getting 60 miles of range on average, the average consumer. Let's see what Bill thinks about this. AC2IS, KTRIW in the TechNet.
Hey, Dick. I was thinking of asking an unrelated question, but just wanted to comment also that cell phones are kind of subsidized by the carrier plans, by the service plans. So it might be a little bit unfair to say that these things are super cheap. On the other hand, I did see a GPS unit for sale today for $30. So maybe that argues in favor of these things being very cheap and affordable. Let me break for a second. I had an unrelated question. I'm going to be, I think, building some short, just you know, very simple antennas soon. I believe I will have an antenna analyzer to help with that. But in the event that I did not have an antenna analyzer on hand, and if I had to test with an HT that I could connect to these 2-meter antennas, and also a software-defined radio that hopefully was pretty good, if not at being calibrated, but giving a signal strength that was good relative to itself, accurate relative to itself, would that be enough for me to empirically test these antennas just to see if I got the length right?
Getting the length right of an antenna really means resonating it. Since every antenna transmitting or receiving, the real radio signal that your transmission line supplies to the antenna, if you're transmitting, doesn't just suddenly hit the antenna and jump into space. It's going to bounce back and forth from that antenna 20 times. Before it finally gets radiated. Therefore, to resonate the antenna means that those 20 bounces will stay in step, coherent with each other, and therefore you get a nice strong transmission. So every real antenna, with rare exception, you're going to resonate it first, then it can radiate. So resonance is the main thing. The size of the antenna, the shape, and whether it's a patch, inverted F, double inverted F, dipole, monopole, 5/8 wave, whatever, all of these antennas of small size that you put in handheld devices have an extremely small amount of real estate, quarter wave or half wave long in free space, and may be shrunk down because of the dielectric constant of your material. Once the antenna is resonated and you can measure a low standing wave ratio, which really means resonant and good impedance matching and maybe good balancing function, then as an antenna, a quasi omnidirectional antenna, it's got to work. It has no choice. And the fact that you've made the antenna, let me drop it. Maybe you're forced for physical reasons to make the antenna 1/2 normal size, 1/4 normal size, 1/8 normal size. That does not change the gain. Only changes the bandwidth. As the antenna becomes physically smaller, use good impedance matching techniques to re-resonate it. You get all of the gain back. You get all the efficiency of transmission back. The infinitesimal dipole can still give you nearly 100% efficiency. But instead of being, let me pick a number, on 80 meters, 300 kc wide, it's going to be 3 kc wide if you make it super small. That's a dipole on 80 meters that's supposed to be 132 feet long, and you decided to make it 32 feet long and re-resonate it with a real good antenna tuner. It's going to be 3 kc wide instead of 300 kc wide. But in that 3 kc, you'll get full performance. So lots of people think when you make an antenna small, the performance has to get small. In bandwidth, yes. In gain and efficiency of transmission, no. It keeps its efficiency. There are very few books that say that. And when it comes to resonate first, then it can radiate, I know of no book that says those words. That's the bedrock of the antenna designing philosophy. I have used that philosophy. Let me drop. I have used that philosophy particularly for the last 10 years of a particular client in which my name is on 30 patent applications for antennas, and 21 of them have already been issued by the Patent Office. Just with that very simple philosophy, the amount of test equipment needed to develop antennas on VHF, UHF frequencies, if you're smart enough and you're a little bit crafty, you'd be amazed how little equipment it takes. Of those 30 patent applications I'm describing, each one of those antennas was developed at 900 megacycles on an antenna range that is 3 feet long. And I'm not kidding. The antenna range used for developing all of those patented antennas was 3 feet long. It existed between the contents table and my desk in my office, with a bunch of anechoic, what is it called now, endless incoming absorbing panels scattered around the place so that I didn't get reflections off the floor and didn't get reflections off the walls. That was in the antenna range. You look at that antenna range compared to what an anechoic chamber usually looks like, and you'll say, no way, this guy's crazy. If you're smart enough and you're a little bit crafty with good ham radio practices, you can do it. So are you getting a little bit of a hint of once you understand some of the philosophy of how an antenna really radiates, it isn't anywhere near as much rocket science as you think, Paul. Paul, here we go. Bill, AC2IS, K2LIW in the TechNet.
AC2IS here, yeah. Thanks for the encouragement, Dick. So I guess my plan would be, these would be quarter wave with antennas. The idea would be to take either copper ground wire or coat hanger material and basically solder that to the center conductor of a piece of coax and connect that to an HT for safety, drop the HT down to quarter power, and then transmit and attempt to measure how well this signal got through to a software-defined radio that was somewhat nearby, and then, you know, vary length and continue to measure. I guess I would have to transmit at both the low end and the high end of the 2-meter band and, you know, mid-range of the 2-meter band and compare values, and do you think that would be adequate?
Yes, but you're making it more complicated than it has to be, Bill. You've used good common sense, and you want to confirm the performance of an antenna by looking at it as a transmitter of a wave that then gets picked up by another receiving antenna into a receiver, into your software-defined radio. You're confirming full pass transmission. You don't have to. As long as you've got... The one piece of magic that I did use to make all this work is I happen to be using a good Roden Schwarz Vector Network Analyzer. It's on your antenna that you intend to transmit with, the antenna that you're testing, the antenna that you're designing. If you've got a good vector network analyzer, in other words, you can measure forward power and reverse power ratio on the transmission line and make the reverse power a small enough percentage so that all of the energy going down that transmission is going into the antenna and none of it's coming back to you. Once you've done that, you don't need to confirm that it transmits. You don't have to confirm that some number of feet away a receiving antenna gets that signal. You don't have to do that. By the law of conservation of energy and knowing a little bit about the antenna pattern, if the signal is going into the antenna and not coming back, and if the antenna is not wasting it, if the antenna is made out of low-loss materials and is not turning it into heat, let me drop, then the only choice it has is it's got to radiate it. If there's any doubt in your mind that the antenna has lossy materials and is turning the energy into heat, then by calorimetry techniques you can confirm that. Put a lot of power into the antenna, do it for a couple of minutes, and find out if anything gets hot. If the antenna is small enough, you put a lot of power into it for a couple of minutes, turn it off, put your fingers on everything, and see if anything gets warm. If the antenna runs ice cold with a lot of power into it, a small UHF antenna, then by definition, it's nearly 100% efficient. If you want to do the real scientific experiment, you look at the antenna with a thermal imaging camera while it's transmitting to find out if anything is glowing on that thermal imaging camera. Is anything getting hot? If you can confirm the energy is going down and not coming back and nothing's getting hot, you don't have to confirm that it's radiated. There is no choice. It's the equivalent of saying, I'm going to build a building out of bricks. but I want to make sure that every one of the bricks is being pulled by gravity just right, so I'm going to drop every one of the bricks. You could do that if you want to. You'd be wasting your time. But you're absolutely... So by the same token, if you can confirm that your antenna is accepting the power and not reflecting it and not turning it into heat, you're home free. You're there. That's it. It is transmitting. You don't have to prove it. AC2RS, K2RIW.
Thanks, Dick. KC2IS here. So the trick here, though, is I believe I will be able to have an antenna analyzer on hand, and then I'll be able to do what you're saying. But, the question is kind of, given that I do not have an antenna analyzer available, is the other method adequate or comparable?
You can go that way if you want to, and it's a traditional way. And it wastes an awful lot of energy, in my opinion, because if you find out at certain frequencies it's not working well, then you got to do a whole lot of analysis to find out where the failure. Is it because the antenna has got VSWR? Is it because the antenna has got a pattern and you're measuring it in the null? Is it because your antenna range has got multipath and the direct signal and indirect signal are canceling each other? Is there something wrong with the receiving antenna? Is there something wrong with the receiver and its sensitivity at that frequency that you just swept through? Once you try to confirm transmission and reception, you fall into three or four more vulnerabilities. You're walking into a minefield. You don't have to do that. If by way of directional couplers that you can build out of pieces of coat hanger wire, and I'm not kidding, to build a directional coupler homebrew is simple as all hell once you understand what a directional coupler is. And with that directional coupler, homebrew or commercial, you can confirm that the forward power is 1 watt and the reverse power is 20 milliwatts, and therefore 97% of the power is going into the antenna, not coming back. Therefore, it's either being turned into heat or radiated. And if you can confirm that nothing's getting hot, then it's not turning into heat. You don't have to prove that it's being radiated. There is no choice. You don't have to drop every brick to find out that gravity's going to pull it down. AC2IS, K2LIW.
Okay, thanks, Dick. So it sounds like, there's some problems with the method I was suggesting, but that under some circumstances it could work. So that is encouraging, and hopefully I'll have the commercial antenna analyzer available to make this job easy.
The easiest way is just to confirm that the antenna is absorbing energy and not wasting it. By definition, it's radiating it because it has no choice. Conservation of energy. That's the easiest approach. It's a very different philosophy. People don't do it that way. In my opinion, they're wasting an awful lot of effort by trying to confirm complete creation of signal, transmission line, transfer of signal, signal going into the antenna, signal radiated by the antenna, signal picked up by an antenna of known gain, standard gain antenna at a known distance, going into a known receiver through a known transmission line of a known VSWR on the receiver. It's a hell of a lot more complicated than just confirming that the signal is being radiated by the antenna you're building. That's all that's required, from my point of view. You make the step, you make the whole process 3-to-1 simpler if you just confirm that it's accepting power and not wasting it. Now, let me get back to this clock situation I was discussing. So, there's a hell of a lot of magic of a high accuracy clock. NASA is using it, and it allows them to talk with the longest range thing mankind has ever created, Voyager number 1, 120 astronomical units, 12 billion miles away. A good respected scientist that a few of us know, who had worked on certain kinds of phased array systems, where he was doing design of ultrasound equipment for human beings, where in the case of ultrasound with an imaging within a human, you've got a conflict, you've got a compromise. The higher the frequency you use, the greater resolution you get of the stuff you want to image inside the human being. That's the good news. The bad news, the higher frequencies of ultrasonics have a great deal of loss when it goes through protoplasm. So if you want to look deep into a human being, you lose a lower frequency. If you want higher resolution, you sacrifice the range and go to the higher frequency. human being as a transmission of ultrasound is a lossy medium. Mother Nature designed something called free space that it's very hard for people to believe it. When the signal goes 12 billion miles, it does not get attenuated. It does not get tired. It just propagates through that hard vacuum of free space, and except for the inverse square law, where it's spreading out over a larger area because of a greater distance, the signal goes there. So it looks like Voyager is not limited for the next 10 years. Let me drop. So we've been doing Voyager for 35 years, and there's reason to believe it'll go for 45 years total. And we'll start looking at the individual characteristics of the galactic wind as it gets deeper into the galaxy outside of our solar system. That's a one hell of a piece of hardware. By 1976 standards, boy, that thing has really got legs. Wow. That is QRP taken to the limit. If you want to calculate miles per watt, I mean 12 billion miles with 23 watts, we're getting close to a billion miles per watt, half a billion miles per watt. Wow. Nothing you and I have ever done has come close to that, or will ever do. Yes, it does require a high-performance 260-foot diameter dish at Goldstone to do the reception, a very low-noise Mesa amplifier, and maybe in some cases you use more than one dish as an interferometer in order to get a stronger signal. If you want to transmit a higher bit rate, if you wanted to, you could do that. It looks like the uplink is not limited. As long as you've got enough transmit power into that dish and you aim it correctly at Voyager, it hears what you say and it'll do what you demand. Beautiful piece of hardware. So there's the accuracy of the clock. Global positioning satellite receivers experience a great accuracy of the clock. And let me give you something else that you don't know about, maybe. Let me drop. Almost every single telephone conversation you have heard for the last 40, 50 years before cell phones came along. We didn't know it, but all of that information was traveling through Ma Bell's system as a single sideband signal. Almost every single thing you heard over telephone was single sideband. And the average ham radio operator says, I can't believe that. It sounded so high fidelity, I could easily recognize the voice of my mother, my brother, my father over that telephone. I could hear the sounds in the background. That was high fidelity. And you listen to normal sideband transmissions over ham radio equipment, it doesn't sound anywhere near that good. How the heck did Ma Bell do that? And the answer is that the local oscillator they re-injected in order to do the sideband demodulation of the signal sent to the telephone system had a carrier injection, call it clock, that had exactly the right frequency and approximately exactly the right phase. You inject the local oscillator with enough accuracy, and the sideband has the capability of being perfect. You'll never know it's sideband. The reason why ham radio sideband sounds so poor is about three reasons. One, for a bunch of reasons, we use speech compression. That gives you some distortion. Number two, it's been through a radio circuit where it's got multipass. That's going to give you some distortion. It's going through a receiver that's got finite intermodulation distortion. That's going to give you some distortion. The local oscillator we re-inject is always going to give you a shift in the frequency. The local oscillator you re-inject by the accuracy you set your tuning dial has always got 10 hertz or 20 hertz of error. Most guys will adjust the sideband signal so the pitch of the voice they're listening to is a little higher than real. For a whole bunch of reasons, it gives you good communication capability, but it gives you a lot of listener fatigue. You hold a long raichu with a sideband signal that's 20 hertz high, and you suddenly realize you've got a lot more mental fatigue, and you didn't know why. I'm going to tell you why. Let me drop. The reason for all that extra fatigue is because the human brain is set up to listen to a very specific signature of human speech. I'm going to round off the numbers. Make believe that my human speech, the basic tone coming out of my vocal cords is 500 hertz when I say, ah. And my vocal cords are not a pure sine wave generator. They're slapping together each individual vocal cord of each individual human being has a different amount of mass of the vocal cords, a different amount of muscle pressure pushing the vocal cords together, a different amount of air going through, a different amount of resonance of the way your throat, nose, and everything else works. The bottom line of all that is that vocal cord is making some 500 hertz. Without a doubt, it's making second, third, fourth, and fifth harmonics. There is a 1 KC note, which is twice 500 hertz. There's a 1500, there's a 2000, there's a 2500, there's a 3000. All of that is coming out of your vocal cords. All of that goes through all of that system that you call the speech generator in your head, and what comes out is a very specific amount of fundamental, a very specific amount of second, third, fourth, and fifth harmonics. When your brain listens to that specific signature of those harmonics, you say, aha, that's Bill's voice. I recognize it immediately. How does the brain recognize that voice so accurately? It looks for that specific signature. Your left ear and your right ear is a thoroughly independent audio spectrum analyzer. It listens to those fundamentals, it listens to those harmonics, it calculates the ratio of all those, and by the speech recognition center, it says, aha, that's Bill's voice, and I recognize Bill. And Bill sounds like he's got a little bit of a cold today, because that ratio slightly got disturbed. But that ratio and those harmonics come out only correctly if you've got an accurate clock. If you've got the right LO, the right frequency and the right phase of injection. Let me drop. And Bob Bell did that on their system because they had a very specific pilot tone transmitted with the signal that allowed them to re-derive a reference oscillator so that they could re-inject the exact frequency on each one of those sideband signals. Along comes a ham radio transmitter. By the way, if I took a tape recording of your voice and I play back the tape recording a little bit fast, you still will recognize Bill's voice. Because if I played a little bit fast, where 500 hertz became 510, 1,000 hertz became 1,020, 1,500 became 1,530, you kept the exact harmonic relationship, even though all of them became a certain percentage higher because you ran the tape recorder higher. That's what happens when you speed up or slow down a tape recorder. Within reason, it's still the same recognizable human being. What happens with sidebands? Let me drop. With sideband, the crazy way it works, if I've got 10 hertz of error in the vocal oscillator I inject, 500 hertz becomes 510. That's okay. 1,000 hertz become 1,010. It should have been 1,020. 1,500 becomes 1,510. It should have been 1,530. 2,000 becomes 2,010. It should have been 2,040. The harmonic relationship is gone. It becomes a dissonant sound. The brain says, I ain't so sure that's Bill's voice anymore. You can see there's a lot of advantage of having the right clock. So GPS needs an exact clock. Every one of your cell phone base stations has an exact clock. It's got an augmented GPS reference oscillator. There's a specific antenna at every cell site looking for the satellites, GPS satellites, and deriving that augmented frequency accuracy in order for the cell sites to be properly synchronized so that they can pass that phone call from cell site number one to cell site number two as you drive down that highway. Without that frequency accuracy, it can't do that. Let me drop. So here we are recognizing that the chip that's in the cell phone, regardless of what the traffic will allow and regardless of what somebody is really charging, that chip itself, you can easily see it. It's probably a quarter-inch square thing, and that's the whole damn, that's the majority of the GPS function that's in your cell phone. That chip doesn't contain gold or platinum or silver. It's ordinary integrated circuit with a reasonable modern-day techniques. The real price of production is not that high. If we add something like that to our television, digital television reception system, then we should have the ability to have a augmented clock in our television reception, and all of a sudden we get back the range, and a hell of a lot of the dropouts that we get in satellite television will probably go away. There's a bunch of speculations on my part, but that's what I think I was hearing for the so-called breakthrough that I called that TechNet that occurred last Sunday evening, where we went for 2 hours and 15 minutes instead of 1 hour on the first section of the TechNet. Anybody got any further questions or comments on what I'm saying? Give me your call letters right now. K2RW in the tech man. Okay, looks like I put all you guys to sleep with this one. And still, in my opinion, it's important. And when the people who are responsible for these techniques, now, where they're going to equalizers of fourth, fifth, sixth, seventh, and eighth generation to try to re-derive the local oscillator that has been corrupted by multipath and impulse noise, these techniques are going to give you some improvement. But if you can short-circuit the process and really make an accurate clock by way of GPS, I mean, we're doing it in all of our cell phones. Why can't we do it without television? Why can't I have back the range that was taken away from me when they went over to digital television? And I'll now have my cake and eat it too. I'll have six programs of material on each individual 6 meg channel. I'll have nice range. I'll have very little dropouts. You make that oscillator, you make that clock in your digital converter, your digital demodulator, you make that clock available with enough accuracy. And I'll give you another example. If you're looking at a radar with a real good modern-day electronic countermeasures receiving system, and you've got an accurate clock on board, where you now can look at the individual residual modulations of each individual radar pulse, the phase shift on rise, the phase shift on fall, the phase shift across the pulse duration itself, when you look at the real characteristics of each individual radar pulse, because you've got the right kind of a clock system, you'd be amazed what data you can look at, you can get out of that. You literally know when they change the tube in the radar. You know if that particular radar, with that particular signature, left New York City and overnight got transported to Albany, if you know what I mean, just to give you a ridiculous example. You know how to track that particular radar if you've got an accurate enough clock with the right kind of a modern-day receiver. There's a lot of advantage of high spectral purity, accurate clocks. And the technology is there to do it as long as somebody starts having enough understanding of why it's worth seeking, why it's worth putting forth the extra dollars and effort to do it. That's a bunch of opinions. You're allowed to say, I'm crazy, but that's the way I see it. I'm
going to repeat your timeout and nothing heard after that. AC2IS.
Okay, I'm listening to 8.5 while I'm transmitting on 3.75. And so I guess you're telling me, Bill, with 3.75, I timed out. Roughly how long ago did it time out, Bill?
I think that was a good 10 seconds or more.
Okay. If it was only 10 seconds, I was a little bit afraid that 15-minute tirade I just gave you guys was all in a dropout. If it was 10 seconds, you didn't lose much. You got the gist. Anybody with any further questions or comments on any of the subjects we've discussed so far tonight, give me a call letters right now. KQRIW in the tech net.
Okay, you too, Jay.
Go right ahead, Eric. And am I completely crazy in having this much faith in the performance improvement that can happen with an accurate clock in a digital, a Spagnoli approach? KQEJ, KQRIW.
All right. By the way, the guy's name is Gary Spagnoli. That's one thing. I was thinking about the whole thing, and the one thing that I haven't been able to clear up in my head is that if you start out with multipath, okay, and even if you have a synchronized clock, you still got a problem. You know, which symbol do you want it to detect, and you know. If the symbols are close enough together, the deflection, I don't think you're going to be able to make it through that.
Okay, let me run with that a little bit, Eric. As the multipath comes along, your ability to re-derive a good, coherent clock starts degrading, and the symbols you're trying to read are also degrading. If I had an accurate clock, wouldn't it be a lot easier to now design a equalizer that now cancels that multipath? Because of the variables that are disturbed, multipath is corrupting two things simultaneously, the accuracy of the clock and the bits you're trying to receive in the presence of the inter-symbol distortion. If I remove one of those variables, the accuracy of the clock, and I've got nothing left but the multipath, which in theory my equalizer can learn and take back out, I think you've got a leg up on reconstituting those corrupted pulses that the multipath took out, or the impulse took out. Over to you, Eric, K2EJ, K2LAW.
I'm having trouble with. Alright, let's say you've got the main signal and a reflected signal, let's say 2 nanoseconds away, or let's say a nanosecond away, because the symbol time is, 1 bit of the symbol time is 5 nanoseconds? I forget, either 2 nanoseconds or 5 nanoseconds, I have to look that up. And that symbol overlaps the other one. Even though you're clocking it out, and let's say you've got sync, you're still not going to be able to decode whether that part of the symbol, because each symbol is really 3 bits. And it's 6 bits, but the trellis is 3 bits, and then there's 3 bits of actual data. So if they overlap each other, you may have trouble determining what the ones and the zeros are.
I'm waiting for the beep. Okay. You and I know what an echo canceller is, Eric. Are you telling me that I can't make an equalizer, an echo canceller, that can operate at the 1 nanosecond of delay? Assume now that the multipath signal is, let me pick a number, 12 decibels weaker and 1 nanosecond delay. If I had enough clock accuracy, can I teach an equalizer, which is a kind of an echo canceller, to have a priori knowledge about that? It's got some kind of a learning technique by which it finds out that there's a continuous echo in there, 12 dB down, 1 nanosecond delayed. Why can't an equalizer take that out, Eric? KE2EJ, K2LAW.
All right. Yeah, it looks like somebody didn't even go to sleep here. Okay. If there's enough amplitude difference, so now that's going to be a hard thing. I suppose I could. I mean, the seventh generation equalizer does a better job, but there's still a limit in which it's going to do it. But of course, it has to extract the clock from it. The trellis in itself, which is a whole other thing, gives it a leg up in terms of being able to deal with it. By the way, the 16 VSB that they designed the cable doesn't include the trellis, but that's why they get the double of bandwidth out of it. Yeah, I suppose that we could make an equalizer that would be good enough if the difference between the reflected signal and the main signal, or the reverse, has enough difference in level that we should be able to, in essence, with stronger. You literally could say, use a comparative, we're looking at it from a single bit perspective, and just simply raise the voltage in which we clip and find the edges. So yeah, I guess we can do that.
Yeah, with the current system, Eric, I believe to get reliable digital television in the presence of multipath, I think we desire that the multipath be something like 15 decibels weaker. But if the clock doesn't have to come out of that demodulation process. If the clock is supplied in high fidelity by an external means, and if I've got a good echo canceller which can learn the multipath characteristics, and if I've got enough real carrier-to-noise ratio, that means I've got an antenna that's looking at Empire. Why can't I have 6 decibels of carrier to multipath ratio, properly train that equalizer? I have no timing errors because I've got a good clock. Yes, I've got to do some fairly careful clipping, and I better have a good carrier to noise ratio to be able to do that. But if the carrier coming through is strong enough in the presence of multipath, I think you could train an equalizer to tolerate 6 decibels of multipath and possibly get a good picture out of that as long as the system is stochastic, as long as that multipath is not jumping up and down in amplitude, it's not waving leaves, it's a reflection off of a water tower, and the water tower is not swaying in the wind, if you know what I mean. So as long as it's a steady multipath, I think 6 dB down is possible. KE2EJ, K2LIW.
No, K2RIW, K2J. Now, one of the reasons why the equalizer has an event and a delay set of taps is because, you know, if you remember a long time ago, we had the discussion of that you actually get a multipath reflection that's actually ahead of the main signal, that if, say, the pre-ghost, if you want to call it that, is stronger than the main signal, or the multipath is stronger than the main signal, it's all a matter of training where the clock is. I mean, once you've established that, and you keep that in the same place, yeah, that should work without a problem. But it's the initial thing that keeps bothering me. How do you teach it where the right place is?
Okay. If I happen to be living in a valley where the echo off of the water tower is delayed, but it's stronger than the direct path, it's only academic that I want to lock up on the reel and not the echo. The fact that the echo is stronger, as long as it's steady and stronger, I'm going to call that the reel. And once I lock the clock on it, why can't I continue to get the reflection off the water tower and say the heck with the direct path, which is the weaker one? I think that's only academic, Eric. KE2EJ, K2LIW, go for the strongest.
No, that's essentially what the equalizers do now. If the reflected signal is stronger, and there are cases where the reflected signal stronger is actually ahead of the main signal, so to speak, because it's reflected from someplace else. Yeah, but my question is, you have to decode the clock that's in the stream to start with. Okay, you've got to be able to get a clear sense of where in time it is, because as you move away in distance from the transmitter, even though we're talking nanoseconds here, the clock's not going to be in the same place as if you're right in front of the transmitter or if you're 50 miles away.
Eric, that's not too different from what happens with a global positioning satellite receiver. One of those satellites I'm listening to is on the horizon. One of them is direct overhead, and I want to use those two. And I have to figure out the huge difference in range, and therefore the huge difference in how many clock pulses downrange. Am I demodulating one versus the other? A GPS receiver can handle that. As long as I've got a good, steady, local clock. And so, if this was the best of all worlds, I would say we haven't devoted enough of the energy of the transmitted signal dedicated to clock synchronization. And if we did do that, it would be taking away a lot of the energy that's really going to be the 6 pieces of programming that's on that 6 meg wide channel. I can see the compromise there. But if I've got a good, steady clock by some external means, and now I do a little bit of experimenting of early, late, and whatever, and I choose the one that gives me the best bit error rate, and there's various ways where there's tests within the vertical interval test system or whatever, during the horizontal retrace or the vertical retrace of the video, there's various test signals you can put in there which could be teaching the system, hey, this is what it should look like, and so adjust your clock accordingly so that your particular leading echo, which happens to be stronger, gives you the least amount of bit error on that test signal, and go for that particular phase of lockup. I think that's doable, Eric. If now I'm not simultaneously deriving clock and simultaneously deriving data with the current system, if I only have to derive data and the clock I've already got, and I've only got to choose how many cycles downrange and how many degrees downrange of that cycle gives me the best demodulation, I think the problem form is 2-to-1 simpler, and maybe even a lot more than that. KE2EJ, K2LAW.
Sorry, KE2EJ. One thing you're forgetting is that in digital television, there ain't no video. There ain't no audio. There ain't nothing that you would be able to say, this is the signal that I need to make a reference to. Like, in the analog world, the ghost canceller, you send a reference signal, and you work on that. As far as digital television goes, it's just data. There might not even be a video, you know, a video stream or a picture stream or a sound stream. It might just be data, like we did for the OEM in New York City. So, deriving the clock is really just a particular sequence of numbers that's surrounded by a pseudo-random number generator. You got to have that exact sequence being decoded to know where the start position is, so to speak. And it's extreme. So it is a little more complicated than what you're suggesting. Echo canceling. Now, that's a pretty good trick. That's why the equalizer is multi-tap, and they try to find, they actually search for that sequence and try and extract it from the stream that's coming in.
Yeah, let me ask you this question, Eric. In the old days of analog television, where I used to have a vertical hold control, and by turning that vertical hold control, I could roll the picture down so that the vertical blanking bar was in the middle of the screen. And in the middle of that vertical blanking bar, I saw all kinds of test signals and digital signals being transmitted, whatever. I think you're telling me with modern-day digital television, if I had the ability to roll down that bar, I think you're telling me I would see nothing. There is no vertical blanking bar and all of its bits and test signals. Is that true, Eric? KE2EJ, K2LAW?
Not exactly. Okay, first of all, we don't send pixel by pixel. Right? The video stream is MPEG-2. It's compressed. That's pretty made out of 8x8 blocks of VCCs. But it does conform to the video standards that you're aware of. In high def, it's actually 1080 by, exactly 1920 by 1080. The end result of the decompression is 1920 pixels on a line, the 1080 line. Actually, the original HD format was 1125 by 60. In layers, you know, it becomes 30. There's so many different video formats, but yeah, you'll see leftover analog closed captions, but the way it works in the digital world, there's a different type of closed captioning, which is actually in the horizontal period, or what you consider to be the horizontal period. So, the stuff is there, and sometimes the stuff is not there. But again, I might be transmitting, you know, 12 radio stations and no picture. So, that lends its own set of problems. Unless, of course, we made some kind of standard that says, here's a training signal. That's actually what the pilot's for. And that's to help the decoder figure out where to start, to decode where to set the AFC at a tuner. And that really came about, when we first started, when there was analog TV and digital TV one next to each other, and the frequency itself was offset, and the pilot trained the receiver's AFC where the heck to be.
Okay. Is there enough of a training signal being transmitted now? Could the amount of training signal be done by the horizontal retrace interval? I know it's not going to work on audio, but if we're just talking about video right now, and it's the video that bothers me most. The fact that I can't get video at anywhere near the range I used to get it is bothering me. And I'm looking for ways of improving that. Better equalization. better training pulses, higher format equalizers, better clocks. There's got to be a way. I am guessing, Eric, that if you wanted to add a little bit more elaborate training pulses during the horizontal retrace interval, I know it's not really there, but you know what I mean. During that period of time, every real television set is sweeping a beam across the screen. So therefore, within the set itself, there is a real horizontal retrace period of time. And training pulses could be transmitted during that period of time. It's the equivalent of the 8 cycles of sync burst we used to have for the chrominant subcarrier, 3.579545. So I know a training pulse could be put in there that could help you align the equalizer faster, find out which is the strongest signal, find out which one you should be looking at, find out which one you should emphasize the echo cancellation on. I'm convinced there's a possibility of significant improvement here, Eric, because everything in my history tells me you start off with an accurate enough clock, with a smart enough engineer designing the system, and boy, can you do magic. And we haven't even gotten into synchronous demodulation yet. KE2EJ, KE2LIW.
KE2LIW, KE2EJ. Well, I got to get you to stop thinking about video, because there's different video standards. First of all, there's the 720p, which is a different sweep rate than 1080i. There's 1080p, which we don't transmit because it sucks up too much bandwidth. And in the order in which we transmit packets which have video and audio, I may transmit 388-byte packets of video, and then a packet of audio, and then a packet of a piece of data, and then maybe I'll transmit 5 packets of video and 3 packets of piece of data, and then 2 packets of audio. So there's no timing essence in the actual, what we call the elementary stream. Okay, the transport stream is the thing that we're interested in. If, let's say, in the transport stream, which I can step a whole lot of stuff, let's say at the beginning of the transport stream, I transmit, I transmit a sequence of 10 zeros and 5 ones and 3 zeros, and I call that the start. That's what I'm going to be looking for. Everything that comes after that is irrelevant.
Okay, would that constitute a sufficiently high fidelity training pulse? Over to you, Eric.
Yeah, actually, we do something like that to get the trellis in the right place. And that's the thing that gets messed up when you're talking about multipath. And that's the thing that we're trying to do a asynchronous demodulation of. So if we make it bigger and we make it longer, and let's say we make it more zeros and more ones to make it so that its duration is going to be longer than, say, any multipath ever will be, then we stand a chance of doing something.
Here I'm going to ask a fairly dumb question. Why is the trellis an asynchronous demodulation? What's stopping that from being asynchronous demodulation?
Nothing other than a reference that, you know, that agrees with the clock that's transmitted.
Okay. You and I have in our hands, so to speak, in our brain right now, the technology that can give it the accuracy of the clock at the transmitter. Your clock at the transmitter either is or easily could be synchronized to the National Bureau of Standards by way of GPS. My television receiver, 20 miles away, could be synchronized the same way. Yes, I've got to figure out how many cycles downrange and how many degrees in that cycle, but I think that's doable. What's the gating item here of making the trellis demodulation synchronous instead of asynchronous? The fact that we've always done it that way is not good enough. I'm beginning to think maybe it could be synchronous, Eric. KE2EJ, KE2LIW.
Yeah, it could be made synchronous. Also, the antenna that you use has to have a GPS antenna as part of it. And if you happen to be a person who's watching on rabbit ears in a, you know, nice built structure building in Manhattan, you may have trouble getting a GPS signal.
Okay. Tell me, how good is the GPS antenna in that cell phone of yours? At a high percentage of that time, that yucky antenna into that terrible device in your hand called cell phone is getting enough GPS to do many of the functions you desire. It's not getting it all the time. But that yucky antenna does it, Eric. Go ahead.
And I can take you to a lot of places where you can have that yucky antenna and get absolutely nothing. And as long as it stays there and you don't move it, it always gets nothing. So the operator just takes a guess at where it's at. And by the way, what was I going to say? Not all cell phones have GPS antennas in them, you know that.
Yeah, I agree with that. However, I'd like to believe a fairly high percentage of the modern ones do have GPS. Go ahead.
As far as, like, even the newer version of LTE, it doesn't require, the phone doesn't require to have a GPS antenna. It gets it from the reference to directory channel, as they call it. So, yeah, in the metropolitan area, you're going to run into trouble. And there are a lot of folks who pick up digital TV with antennas in their apartments.
Saying is that in the metro area, quite a few people with rabbit ears in their apartments are getting digital television today with some degree of reliability. They know that they're within range of 30 channels, but because of the various ways that the multipath falls now in those various channels, I'll bet you they're not getting all of them on those rabbit ears, Eric, even if they're in a major metro area, particularly with the particular under the umbrella antenna patterns that we've got in the metro area toward the east, toward Long Island. K2EJ, K2LAW.
K2LAW, K2EJ. Well, we can talk about that all we want. There's actually quite a number of folks that are using rabbit ears in the metropolitan area. And they don't necessarily get all the channels all the time. Somebody can walk across the room and it disappears. But those with the later model sets, with the later model equalizers, don't seem to be having those problems. We get the phone calls all the time, so. Actually, I got a phone call from a guy the other day who, in the city, who picks up Channel 21 from out here on his antenna. And he was having difficulty asking if we changed anything, but it was just atmospheric.
Okay, in the case of the atmospheric, there's all kinds of relearning that the equalizer is going to have to develop. If I went into a good store selling digital television receivers today, and I investigate most of the major brands, what percentage of them do you believe being sold today have a seventh generation equalizer, a sixth generation equalizer, a fifth generation equalizer, and so on? Where are they in the equalizer generations in the currently sold sets? And when I read the data sheet, the owner's manual, I'll bet you that information is not there. By some of the means, I've got to find that out, is my guess. KE2EJ, K2LAW.
K2LAW, KE2EJ. You will never find that in an owner's manual. And if the stock that was developed, I think a year and a half ago now, there's no more third generation equalizers out there. By the way, they seem for some reason to go by odd numbers. The fourth generation equalizer was an experimental and never produced. The sets that you find today will have the fifth generation equalizer, and you probably won't see the seventh generation for the next 2 or 3 years.
And the most obvious question, Chris, here we go, Eric, if I waited a couple of years for the seventh generation to become available to me, or if I use all the smarts of all the people I know and by hook or by crook I get a seventh generation, what's your guess as to how much better is the seventh versus the fifth? Is it worth waiting for? K-E-2-E-J, K-2-R-I-W. IAW.
Now, I'm willing to bet that you're experiencing now the computers that you have third-generation equalizers in them. Fifth-generation equalizers, one light year is better than the third, and I don't know how much better the seventh is going to be, but it's going to be somewhat better, but not lightning years ahead.
Yeah, you're going to think that I'm pretty foolish to use a set-top converter into an old-fashioned analog CRT television, and it's probably third generation. And my guess is nobody's going to sell me a set-top converter that's fifth generation. I've got to go out and buy a real TV set. And so I think you're saying that some of the things that I'm hollering about is because I'm too many revs down compared to what some people are owning. However, half of the village of Dix Hills is reasonably high above sea level. It's got some valleys. It's got lots of peaks. I can drive up and down every single street. 25,000 people in this community of 26 square miles. From all I can tell, only one single human being in this community that's 28 miles east of New York City, 33 miles east of the Empire. I'm airline 33 miles east of Empire, a reasonably affluent community, 25,000 people, only one of them is watching over-the-air television. Something's not quite right about that, Eric. KE2EJ, KE2LAW.
KE2LAW, KE2J. Well, I bet you, because I remember when, a long time ago, when we wired up, when there was Huntington cable TV there, and antennas stopped coming off the roof, which is, well, this was in the 70s already. Actually, I know a couple of people that live not too far from you, and they do actually have antennas, and they do actually watch it, but they're television people. One of the things that you will find, especially on this side of Jane Hill, today you'll see more and more brand new antennas on roofs, and I've counted quite a few of them. And the reason for that is nobody wants to pay $200 a month for cable. And when they discover that the picture quality is far greater than what cable or satellite provides, they kind of stick with the antenna. They like it, so they don't get HBO. But, as I was telling you the last time, there's EVSD, or enhanced VSD, which is for mobile reception in your cell phones and stuff like that. And there, they're allowed to actually charge subscription television. This is what the broadcasters are going to be relying on pretty soon. We went through that discussion already. K2RW, K2JL, and, you know, Jenikowski, when he was the head of the FCC, did everything possible to try and make broadcasting go away. So Congress kind of liked that idea and continued on with it.
Yeah, that was one man's opinion. I'd like to believe he doesn't represent the whole FCC, so to speak. You said some of these are television people. What does that mean, television people? Does that mean somebody who works in broadcast and really understands RF and how to set up a system to get the best reception? Or somebody who's just hooked on television? That's question number one. And I had a second question, which is going out of my mind. Over to you, Eric, K2RIW.
Well, some people are pretty general in terms of they're involved in either producing, not necessarily have to be technical. They're involved in television production in some form, be it just a producer, writer, production assistant, or camera person, audio person, those kind of people.
Okay, now, I do get approximately 50 channels when I look at New Jersey, New York, Connecticut, Southern New York State, Long Island, and so on. And by the way, occasionally I do get channel 42-12345, which is on 54 to 60 megacycles. But I got to use one of those very quiet days when the power line is not making any noises. Now, cable television. I am having impression from what you said, cable and fiber. are not getting digital quality on very many of their channels. I mean, what percentage of the material that I get for $200 a month with cable TV or fiber, what percentage of them has the